Hi, my name is Richie Kay. I'm your leader for today, and I'm a very grateful recovering compulsive overeater. And I have a reputation for being the most laid-back retreat leader in the program, and yet it sounded to me like how it works was unfinished. So my perfectionism, which comes up occasionally, insists that I finish, because I was doing a retreat recently, and someone got up at the retreat the second day and said that their sponsor told them they needed to do 30 meetings in 30 days, and if they didn't read How It Works, it didn't count as a meeting. So I figured we have to finish it if it doesn't count. So anyone who's doing 30 meetings in 30 days, you'll be at a meeting, okay? So let's see where we left off. Our description of the compulsive overeater, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive overeating. And C, that God could and would if he was to it. So I guess I had to read that because God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself, and you know, all the other things never worked, and I need to be reminded all the time. And why I'm your leader today is real simple. It's because I have a gift. I have many gifts. The biggest gift I have is that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps of the program, and now I'm experiencing the joy of living on a daily basis for almost 9 years now. And I have the ability to share that gift on a level that people seem to relate to. All I am is a byproduct of God's handiwork and the love and the people of the fellowship, you people in these rooms, etc. One of the things I learned for myself now, compulsive overeaters are a strange breed of people. And when I say that, I'm starting with myself. Now, I've been to many, many Overeaters Anonymous functions all across this country, including Canada. And you'll never make a group of compulsive overeaters happy. So before we get started, I want to say that if there's 100 people here today, 50 of you are going to be too warm, and 50 of you are going to be too cold. So no matter how and what we do with the air conditioning or whatever, only half of us are going to be happy all day long. So try to be that half, you know? Try to be in that half, you know? If you focus on what we're here for, the temperature will not affect you. If you focus on the temperature, you will hear nothing that goes on here today. So that's my experience. But for those of you who are cold, I think what we need to do is start out with a hug, okay? Now, I need a volunteer to come up to demonstrate the rights and wrongs of hugging. And this is the experience I've learned over my 8-some-odd years in OA. The first hug, and Kenny, you'll have to bear with us here. The first hug, which I learned was wrong, is called the A-frame, which is two people like this to form the letter A. And it never really did much for me, okay? So that's out. The second one is a side saddle hug. Hi, how you doing? Never did much for me. And the third, now, it's okay. I love when people rub my back and pat me, but when they try to burp me, it gets offensive. So, like, that kind of burping stuff, you know, doesn't work. Now, one other clue for tall women or tall men, when you're hugging someone short, if you want to do this, it doesn't help, you know. But if you just bend your knees a little and get eye to eye, and you just, you know, give a nice, loving hug, okay? So I would suggest that we all get three hugs to start the morning. Goes on, and there are some people here who have experienced being at retreats with me and getting hugging lessons. But as the day goes on, we will have different little intervals where we will have more hugs, and each ensuing hug will include more people. Our next hug will be a three-person hug, and so on and so forth. And basically what the format will be for today is God as we understand him. But what I would like to do is I will share on my experience. Actually, what I want to share about is the true meaning of this program, which is love, you know, unconditional love. The thing that makes this program work, in my experience, is the love that I have coming up from this room to this podium at this very moment. The unconditional love and acceptance that I've gotten from the minute I walked into my very first meeting, even though I didn't know it because I was too anesthetized to know it. And my feeling of joy and love that I can give to you, the joy of living to me has turned out to be the ability to help another human being and the ability to be unselfish enough to want to do that. And that's the gift of this program. And that's what truly, beneath all the bullshit, is if you unconditionally love and accept each and every person exactly for who they are and where they are at this very moment, that's the key to the whole thing. It says in the big book, I get so many gifts in this program, spiritually, emotionally, materially. I was at the World Service Delegates Convention recently doing hospitality, and a friend of mine from New Orleans gave me a tape of Dr. Paul, the guy who wrote the chapter, Dr. Addict Alcoholic. And I listened to that tape on the way out here, driving out yesterday. And there's just so many great things in there, you know, that he says. And it's just, and what he says, in essence, is one of the things on page 132 in the big book. And I love the way he describes it. He says, in the center of the page, the very center, there's 12 lines above it, there's 12 lines below it. And right in the very middle of the page, is the sentence that says, it doesn't say we suggest, it doesn't say perhaps, it doesn't say sometimes. I'll just read exactly what it says. And it's so funny because I had that page turned down. And it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. That's what it says right in the middle of that page. And I know God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free, not to be miserable, fat, and, you know, full of fear. And I was one of those people who believed life was just something that you had to sustain and drudge through and suffer through, etc. Well, for the last 8 years and maybe, what month are we in? May, we're almost in June, God. Time flies when you're having fun. July will be 9 years that I've been walked into my first OA meeting, and 2 days later I got the gift of abstinence, and I've been abstaining ever since. Yeah. And in that period of time, I've been maintaining somewhere around a 200-pound weight loss for 8.5 of those years. About, I came in. They told me that the way you would eat would take off the weight, and the way you live keeps it off. Well, the way I ate took it off, and the way I'm living keeps it off. Sometimes it doesn't keep it all off as I would want it to. Sometimes I don't look as close to Arnold Schwarzenegger as I wish I did. But then I get to be reminded by people like you who say to me little catchphrases like, I may not be what I want to be, and I may not be what I think I should be, but through the grace of God, I'm sure not what I used to be. And that's in every area of my life. I may not eat the way I want to eat every single meal of every single day, but I sure don't eat the way I used to eat, you know. My obsession was lifted when I had a spiritual awakening as the result of working steps to the best of my ability. I don't have an obsession with food. When I first got here, my obsession was 24 hours a day. I was either thinking of how I was going to eat without someone seeing me next, then at the meal, when I could stop if I could, and right after the meal, when I can get my next one, or how I could stop. You know, it was always going to bed thinking, oh God, did I eat enough? to fall asleep, or how am I going to not eat when I get up in the morning? And that was constant. I don't have that anymore. I sincerely haven't had that for years. I have not had that burning obsession that I got to get something to eat or I'm going to die, because I know that's not true. Over the years, as far as abstinence, it's changed, and it has to change. I just want to say this, and then I'll get back to what I was going to tell you about the format. The first definition of abstinence I heard was the best. It said, find a food plan that you can live with, make a commitment to that food plan, and live with the commitment. And I've been doing that now for almost 9 years. The commitment changes because I can't live with certain commitments I make forever. One of the things that I've learned is to never say never. I can never say that I will never have a quarter Häagen-Dazs ice cream. If I feel I want to, I'll say, well, I'll have it tomorrow. But just for today, I don't need to have it. And then when tomorrow comes, it's today. So just for today again, I don't have to have it. And a day at a time, you know, my first sponsor, I remember going to a meeting and hearing someone share, well, I've been abstaining now for 5 years. I eat 3 meals a day, weighed and measured, nothing in between but non-caloric beverages, and I plan on doing that the rest of my life. And I looked at him. I said, are you serious? I said, I got to do that shit. He goes, oh, no, not you. He said, that's for those people. He said, you don't have to do that. I said, oh, great. What do I have to do? He said, do you think that just for today you can eat 3 meals a day, weighed and measured, with nothing in between except non-caloric beverage? I said, oh, yeah, I could do that, standing on my head in the phone booth. He said, well, do it for today. That's all you have to do. I go, oh, great. He said, and tomorrow you could eat anything you want. He said, but for today, just do that. I said, great. He says, then call me in the morning. I said, okay. And I did it. And I called him in the morning, and he said, how'd it go? I said, it was a snap. He says, well, do it again today. He says, can you? I said, oh, yeah. I said, are you kidding? I said, I got momentum now, you know. And that's really how it happened for me. I did. It's like a day at a time I could do anything. And I never say that I'll never have this again, I'll never have that again. And somehow along the way, in January 1980, I applied the same thinking and the same willingness to giving up drugs, alcohol, and cigarette smoking. I'm not a member of AA, I'm not a member of NA, I'm not a member of DA, but somehow God has removed my need to use substances and people and everything else to fill up, and I've been filled up with the joy of living. So now to get back to what I plan to do today is I plan to share my experience, strength, and hope, and whatever I say is just come out. But I'm going to try and do like the first three steps this morning and my experience with them. However long that takes me to share, we will take like a 5-minute mini break. And then I will give you people time to share your experience, strength, and hope on the first three steps and what it means to you and what your experience is, because I need to learn. I need to hear. I need to get new ideas. And it's your opportunity, it's your day, it's your marathon, it isn't mine. I'm just here, you know, to be a little channel for the big guy in the sky. And so then we'll share your experience, and we have an Ask It basket. Where is it located? Okay. And there will be a pad and a pencil in there. And what I would like you to do is we'll put it somewhere convenient, like by the coffee table. And anybody that has any questions about anything, because I do have all the answers, you know. At the end, I will take 15 minutes at the end of the morning, and I will try to share my experience, strength, and hope on any of those questions that you may ask. So if there's anything that you want to find out about today, if you have something that's bothering you, that you feel you need, it has to be shared about, this is your opportunity to do it without feeling dumb or silly or anything like that, because you can anonymously put it down on a piece of paper. So that's what I will do. Then we will take a lunch break from 12 to 1:15, and we will reconvene at 1:15 here. And then this afternoon, I will share the remaining steps in segments. We'll do maybe steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, and then take a mini break mid-afternoon. And I will share first, then you will share a little bit, then we'll do an Ask It Basket. Then we'll take a mini break, and then we'll share steps 8 through 12, or if I get 8 and 9 in the first half, however it works out, whatever, you know. So that's basically the format. Thank you. It's my valet, Kenny. Thanks for helping everyone. And so that's basically what we're going to do. If you have any questions, put them in the Ask a Basket. If you have any suggestions on something else you'd like to cover. But I can only tell you that by sharing my experience with the 12 steps, I'll be sharing my experience with things like abstinence, God, turning it over, any of the cliches you want to hear, we'll cover them, and so on and so forth. So I started talking about abstinence. I believe for me, taking the first step was coming to my first meeting. Because if I thought I could still handle it, I would never, never have come to these rooms. You know, it says in the book, we don't come skipping in here, tra-la-la. We come in here beaten down to our knees. And my experience is my experience. And the person that brought me to my first OA meeting suggested strongly that we smoke a joint before we come because she thought I would have a lot of trouble taking you people straight. She was 100% right. I could hardly take you stoned, you know what I mean? I thought you were entirely too nuts for me. And the very first meeting I went to, which a couple of people in this room may relate to, was a place called Gardner Street in L.A., and someone told me later on, they said that if you went to Gardner Street as your first meeting and you came back, you really were desperate. You know what I mean? And it was just like all the people there were kind of unconventional, to say the least, you know. But I thought they were all nuts. Now, today, I know they are, but I'm the craziest of all. And yet the sanest, and they're all sane, and it's all a matter of process. It's what my eyes saw and what my heart felt. And the thing that really encouraged me the most was that I really felt the unconditional love that I talked about earlier, that these people really cared in spite of my hostility. I have pictures. Wait. That'll show you what I was like when I got here. And there's one picture in there that's great, one of the smaller pictures, is of me extremely heavy, but smoking a joint. And in the palm of my hand was a package of rolling paper, because I was so compulsive I couldn't wait to finish and roll another one, you know. But that was indicative of my behavior. So I went in, my hair was down to my shoulders, I always wore a headband, and I had these little humble sayings, like when people say, why do you wear a headband? I go, like, to keep my head together, you know. And you guys loved me to death. You know, you loved me to death. At the break, I mean, the very first thing I heard when I came in the room was the word God, the serenity prayer. And I gave a little tape to my friend. I looked at it and she said, take what you want and leave the rest, you know. And I looked and she said, just stay, you know. And then I looked at the podium and they had the serenity prayer on there. So the first word I ever saw in OA was God. And I looked at her again and she said, take what you want and leave the rest, you know. So I had a lot of trouble getting through the first half of the meeting. And I didn't hear very much. So my plan was, at the break, to sneak out to the parking lot, get in the car, smoke another joint, and wait for her till the meeting ended. And someone screwed up my whole life, because as I was slithering out the door, she came up and said, how about a hug? And she hugged me in spite of myself and said, "We love you, keep coming back." And she gave me some literature. Well, I was too embarrassed to leave now, see. So I had to go back to my seat, and naturally the second half of the meeting I heard exactly what I needed to hear, which was simply a girl who went to UCLA sharing about in her dorms that they used to make chocolate chip cookies and eat half of them before they even got in the oven. And I went, "Oh, yeah, I do that all the time, you know." And then she shared about how they would bake lasagna, and she would get up in the middle of the night and eat the tray cold. And I went, "Well, that's the way it tastes best, you know." And I kind of related to a lot of things I heard, which that and the hugs that I got and the people who said keep coming back encouraged me to come back. And I took home, and I haven't shared this lately, I bought two pamphlets for 45 cents. One was, I think, A Commitment to Abstinence, and the other was, I don't know the name of it, the one that asks you the 15 questions, and if you answer four or more yes, then you probably are a compulsive overeater. So I had 14 yeses and a maybe. And after learning what rigorous honesty really was, it was 15 yeses. So I'm more than qualified to be a compulsive overeater. But the commitment to abstinence, there was just a paragraph in there, and I wouldn't remember it. If I read it, I could read it to you. And it just talked about what a commitment to abstinence meant. It meant a commitment to recover. Now, I've heard many people share that you can work this program eating, you know, just as you could work AA drinking. But how effective could it be? Now, I know for me, and again, it's my experience, the big book says in the doctor's opinion that nothing but complete abstinence to clear the fog away from our brain will enable us to go on and really comprehend what these steps in the program is really about. It says in the 12 and 12 in step one, it says nobody who is still eating can comprehend what, nobody who is still eating can comprehend, wait, I'll read it. It's that the drugs kick in every once in a while after 10 years, you know. It says, why all its insistence that every OA must hit bottom first? The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice the OA program unless they have hit bottom. For practicing OA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no compulsive overeater who is still eating can dream of taking. So that's what the book says. And everything the book says so far in my experience in almost 9 years has come true in my life. There is nothing in that big book or in that 12 and 12 that doesn't describe some form of my recovery. So I never question what the book says. There are parts in the book that says, talks about our sexual behavior. I'm just skipping around, but it comes to mind. And it says that if we continue harming people, if our actions are harmful to other people and we ask God to help us to change, we'll be fine. But if we continue harming other people, we will eat. This is not a theory, it's a fact. Now, I know that when the book says something that strongly, I have to look at my behavior sexually. I have seen many, many people who have continued using sex and harming other people go out there and eat again. So obviously the book knows what it's talking about. So when it says that no one who is still eating can dream of taking the attitudes and actions required of the steps, I could tell you that's my experience. I needed to abstain for 5 months. Let's see, August, September, October, about 5.5 to 6 months. I lost over 180 pounds a day at a time. A pound at a time. I didn't starve myself. And while I'm on that topic, I'll tell you that my first abstinent was what they would call how abstinence now. It was gray sheet then. And it was like, you know, Nazi gray sheet. And it was like, and this is my experience again. It's like, it was three weighed and measured meals a day with nothing in between. My lunch was a finger salad, which was 7 fresh vegetables, you know. And if I would make a salad bar and a raisin would fall in, I would get a new plate. You know, that's how severe I was. But that's how I had to be. I had a lot of weight to lose, and I had a lot of willingness to do it. But I could tell you that after the first few days, and what I mentioned before about having the momentum of a day at a time, that it was more than enough food to fuel my body. I've never taken a vitamin. Well, I can't say never. I've tried, because of people pleasing. A dear friend of mine in New York, I was visiting about 3 years ago, gave me all these tests to see my imbalances and stuff. And I bought about $60 worth of vitamins for her, including something called something glutamate, which is for the brain, right? So my friends in New York said, well, they knew I had brain damage, that one would be good. And I never used them because they never did anything for me. But knowing a lot from my prior years before OA of losing 100 pounds or more 6 or 7 times, going to Duke University, to the fat farm, doing it all, I knew a lot about nutrition and how to eat. I didn't know how to maintain it. OA has taught me that. God is doing for me on a daily basis what I couldn't do for myself. But at the beginning, you were God. Somehow, the group was my higher power. Like, you know, all I could say was, this shit works. You know, I'd go to a meeting and I'd hold hands with people saying prayers that I didn't even know. I would go, you know, for like 4 months, I didn't even know the Serenity Prayer. That's where I was at, you know. But the power of the group helped me to abstain, plus the day at a time. My sponsor reminded me, oh, you just got to do it today. Oh, great, I could do it today. And every day I got to do it. And then I heard things at meetings that would be very helpful to me. Like somebody said, God, I always think that I'm going to faint between lunch and dinner, but I never do. And I said that to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, you won't faint. If you do, you'll be abstinent. You know? So I was abstinent about 2 months, and I was at Magic Mountain with my two daughters. And you know, OA teaches you a lot of things, good, bad, and indifferent. You know, I've learned things in OA that I never heard before, like people eating breakfast at 3 a.m., you know, and stuff like that. So I never had those thoughts, but they were planted because I heard it at meetings. So here we were at Magic Mountain. We had lunch. Oh, that was another thing. My meals were 8 a.m. breakfast, noon lunch, 6 p.m. dinner. God helped the person that was in front of me at 5 to 12 and wanted to give me money, have a conversation, whatever it was, not a chance. I had to get there at noon and start eating. So here we ate at noon, and it was about 2 o'clock, and I felt like I was going to faint. So I said to my daughters, I said, I think I like to eat dinner early. And they went, Dad, it's 2 o'clock. We just had lunch. I go, no, a lot of people do that. You know, the metabolism changes, and, you know, our body shifts, and sometimes we need to eat our meals, you know, earlier. And I said, I really think I'm going to faint. And then I remembered, well, if I faint, I'll be abstinent, you know? And I go, well, I said, and then my daughter said the magic word. She said, why don't you have a cup of coffee? I went, oh, yes, coffee. I can have coffee. That's right. That's allowed. I can. And I got really excited. I mean, doesn't take much to excite us, does it? You know what I mean? And I had coffee, and then we went on a couple of rides, and about 6:45, my daughter said, are we going to eat dinner? Like, I'm starving. And I went, oh, my God, that shit works. You know, it's like, that stuff about wait 10 minutes, it'll pass. All those little things really work if you're willing to do it, if you're willing not to give in to that momentary gratification. And I could just tell you that many times in my 8.5 years, I've given in to the momentary gratification of eating too more than I would like to eat, eating the kind of foods I don't like to eat. And I always suffer from the aftermath of remorse and self-pity and guilt. Oh, why did I do that? And one of the other cliches I heard is so true, that nothing tastes better than the taste of abstinence. You know, nothing's better to me. We talk about self-esteem, self-worth, all that stuff. you know, a lot of things make me feel good. I feel real good that I'm an unconditionally loving human being today. I feel real good that I'm not a vindictive person, that I'm not a critical or judgmental person most of the time. But nothing makes me sleep better than a good abstinent day. You know, you can come up to me and tell me that I'm the second coming of Jesus and all that stuff, and if I have a bunch of croutons in my salad, I'm going to feel like shit. You can tell me I'm a piece of shit, and if I had three clean meals, I feel terrific. Doesn't matter. And that's like the essence of my self-worth comes from how good I'm abstaining. So, yeah, abstinence does come first. But, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, I couldn't tell you. But I know that all the gifts I have of being willing to give up the first bite or the extra bite comes from the power of God that I've gotten through working the 12 steps of the program. So that was what I had to do. I had to abstain no matter what and trust that the rest would follow. I wasn't interested in any of the steps. I remember somebody asking me, oh, 4 or 5 months into the program, if I had read a certain thing in my big book. And I said, which one is that? They said, you know, the blue one. I said, oh, the one that costs $5? No. No, I got these pamphlets for 45 cents, but like $5 was not a worthy investment for me yet, because I just needed to abstain. I had the gray sheet and stuff like that. That's all I needed. And as most people know, it's no big deal. I'm an actor, and that's how I earn a living. My real job is working for God. So I work for God, and I earn a living as an actor. My job is working for God. And anybody in this room has the same job as me, whether you know it or not, and the way you earn a living is just part of doing the job for God. So part of that is that when I do work, I earn an awful lot of money. And there are times like now where there's a writer's strike, that work isn't that abundant, you know. So because of this program, I've learned to live moderately and not feel any pressures. And the reason I don't feel any pressures is because I know that God has a plan for me. You know, right now, as God would have it, I'm doing a lot of radio commercials. And I can't tell you, at least 50 people, and that's keeping it short, have called me up over the last couple of months and say, you know, things like, I've been driving on a freeway, and I was really pissed. I was in all this traffic, and all of a sudden I hear, rah, 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 rah. I go, Richie, and my whole attitude changes. So that's how God uses me. Now, if he chooses to use me as a plumber the rest of my life, and that's how I can carry the message best, then I'm going to be a plumber the rest of my life. So why should I have any anxieties over my career when I know that my career is working for God and he'll pick where I do that? See? So all these actors that are into... I did a pilot this season. And what that means is that they do a certain amount of pilots, and then in May, the networks announce their full lineup. So if they announce your pilot, that means you got a series. Okay? So I did this pilot, and I had a lot of fun, and the best thing that came out of it was that the two producers wrote me a note and said, thanks not only for your contributions as an actor to enhancing the show, but for your attitude that carried throughout the whole cast. So there I did my job. I was a channel of love and peace and harmony and faith and hope and light and joy, which is what I'm supposed to do. So that validated that I did my job well, and I let go the rest of it. Well, every actor in the show has called me 2 or 3 times a week, did you hear anything? Did you hear anything? And I get to use words that they understand better than powerlessness. I go, hey, you got no control over who at the network decides whether they like a show or not. Go to the beach, you know, enjoy your life, and more will be revealed, you know? And it's like, that's the way my life is today. Nothing happens by mistake. This morning, Kenny and I were talking at the motel, and he said, what happened to your car? And I realized, I forgot, a week ago Sunday, I guess it was, I was coming back from my aerobics class, and I do my usual thing of going through McDonald's, and getting my decaffeinated coffee. And I'm talking to the box, you know, like all morons do. And I'm ordering a decaf, and one of the McDonald's delivery trucks, a trailer, ran over the roof of my car. He didn't, and I said, "What are you, crazy?" And I'm beeping my horn. I said, "Stop, stop." And I didn't realize this is all coming in through the mic. So the whole store came running out with the manager, you know, wondering what happened. And the guy said there was a blind spot and he never saw me. You know, I have a low car. I have a sports car. And the trailer ran over the roof of my car. And Kenny said, well, I said, you know, I forgot all about it. But what happened was 2 minutes later, there was this nice family there said, "Oh, you get a lot of money, man. McDonald's, you sue them, man," you know. So my next thought was, does my neck hurt? You know, does my shoulder hurt? You know, and the manager at McDonald's was, you know, came out with my coffee. This was funny. And he said to me, he said, "Are you hurt?" You know, and my head said yes, but my mouth said no. You know what I mean? And I said, "No, I'm fine. I'm just pissed about this car thing," you know. And then all of a sudden, my God consciousness said, "Richie, it's only a car. Billions of people have car accidents, and let's get into the solution," you know. And there I was, exchanging information. He didn't have insurance, so now my head says, "Call the cops, the man will get arrested," you know. And this guy says, "There goes my safe driving award, there goes this, it's a new truck, and this and that." And I said, "Well, where's the insurance?" He said, "Could you call a company? It's not my truck, the insurance." I said, "No problem," you know. And I did the whole thing, called my insurance agent, and turned the whole thing over. And I have an appointment Tuesday for an appraisal. So it's like gone, you know, the problem is gone. And when Kenny said that, I realized I haven't even had like one minuscule thought about poor Richie and his car. He didn't do anything. You know, it's a car. I mean, I'm grateful that I have a car. That I came out here and I have great air conditioning in the car and a great sound system and I listen to this great tape. And who cares if the roof is a little screwed up? You know what I mean? It's like it didn't affect the air conditioning or anything. And I've gone years in this program without a car and been just as happy. You know, all my material things, all my material gifts are just like luxuries in my life. They're just simply toys that enable me to play better. If I didn't have that car tomorrow, if I didn't have the car 2 days ago, I would take a bus out here and do this marathon. I've done that in the past. You know, I've taken the RTD bus in L.A. from Santa Monica to Long Beach to speak at a dinner dance, and I was dressed like this, and everyone was in gowns and tuxedos. And I didn't feel out of place or anything, and it was like, it was great. I just have to tell a story. At the time, as usual, I was involved in the OA show for our annual birthday party in January that we have, and I've been involved in about 6 or 7 out of the 9 years I've been in OA. And this particular time, I had written, directed, and cast it, and I wasn't in it. But I had done all the footwork in that. So I was dressed similar to this, except I had, like, I sweats with the arms cut off or something. And I had a Walkman that I had on with me. And I had the script from the OA show. And every week at rehearsal, the cast would be in panic. They go, "Richie, the show isn't, like, coming together. What's going on?" And I would have in big block letters on the back of my script, "God's in charge." And I would always hold that up. I go, "Forget it. God's in charge." And if any of you have ever been to the OA birthday, you know that the night of the show, it's always perfect, no matter what, no matter how disastrous it may be. So now I took the RTD, and I don't know how many people are familiar with LA, but I took the RTD. What I had to do was take the number one bus to Hill Street and Fifth in LA. Now, I didn't realize, but I found out afterwards, that's where all the Duralex and winos hang out and party, like by that bus stop. And then I had to change and take a bus to Long Beach, where someone picked me up at the bus station and took me to this dinner dance. So afterwards, when I was sharing it and related the story, somebody said to me, they said, "Well, weren't you scared?" And I said, scared of what? They go, like standing for an hour on 5th and Hill Street, like, you know, in danger. So I said, no, the big book says that if we're going to carry the message, we never have to worry about danger or anything like that, as long as we're doing God's work. I said, and besides, if you think about it, because someone pointed this out to me, here I was with this, like, ripped sweatshirt with a Walkman carrying this book that says God's in charge, you know, in front of it. Like, they thought I was the biggest weirdo in the neighborhood, you know, so no one's going to bother me. But those are the kind of things that I don't even think of, because if you really, for me, from the day I surrendered my will and my life to the care of God, my fears ended. My